You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
In 2010, the BC government bowed to pressure and banned all mining and oil and gas development in the pristine Flathead Valley. That valley borders national parks in Alberta and the United States. The province has since been negotiating settlements with several mining companies that had claims in the valley. Last month, Klein Mining filed a notice in the Supreme Court of British Columbia claiming that its coal license application rights were injuriously affected by the ban, and they're asking for $500 million in damages. Joining us to discuss the lawsuit is Casey Brennan. He's a program manager with WildSight. Hello, Casey, and welcome to Vancouver Cooperative Radio.
Hi, Mordecai. It's great to be here.
Now, I'm really puzzled. How is it possible for a company to sue for $500 million over a rejected claim?
It's often called takings. It's a takings claim, and it's a basic principle of law and legal precedent that has to do with lost benefit from private property. And so that's essentially what Klein is claiming here, is that they had a benefit designated under the Mineral Tenure Act. They had and the Mining Act. They had rights to conduct operate a mine that they have now been denied because of a change in policy and change in law. So they're saying that the government owes them money for lost potential profits.
So I lose my right to exploit the terrain, and I win your money anyway.
You win all of our money. It's the taxpayers of British Columbia that would be on the hook for this. And it was, let me be very clear, this was not private property. This was our land. This is a public crown land, as it's called, that they owned mineral tenure as well as a coal lease. And so they had started the process of trying to get a mine permitted in the area, but they were a very long way from any permits for operating a mine, yet now they say they can claim lost potential profits when they weren't even allowed in by the people of British Columbia to conduct a mining operation. They hadn't even submitted a comprehensive plan as to how they would do that. Their plan was very, very incomplete.
Let's go to the decision that was made to say that mining will not take place in that area. How did that decision come about?
Well, it was a long process, over 30 years of people in the area saying, trying to let the folks down, way down in Victoria, know that mining was not an appropriate activity for the beautiful Flathead Valley. It's a very large area, about 150,000 hectares, over that, almost 160,000 hectares, and it's right against the Canada-U.S. border, and the Flathead River flows south and crosses the Canada-U.S. border, and it becomes the western boundary of Glacier National Park, which people think of Glacier National Park in Canada, and they think of Revelstoke, but and the Rogers Pass. But there's actually a Glacier National Park south of the line, which is actually one of the most famous parks in the U.S. It's called the Crown Jewel, one of the crown jewels of the U.S. park system. And there's also a designation on the river once it crosses the Canada-U.S. border as a wild and scenic river, which is the highest level of federal protection that a river can be afforded in the United States. And there was a coal mine proposal there in the late 70s, early 80s that was vehemently opposed by both Canadians and residents of the Elk Valley here where I live, and where there has been over 100 years of coal mining, and people know coal mining very well. And people then and people now said that, you know, the Flathead is not a place for a coal mine, and there was well-organized protests, but that didn't stop the decision-makers down in Victoria and Vancouver. They kept forging ahead until the matter got referred to what's known as the International Joint Commission, which is a body that oversees the 1909 Boundary Waters Treaty, which was one of the first environmental treaties in North America, certainly if not the world, which was originally signed to sort of govern the Great Lakes, but has since been used in many cases. People may remember the Devil's Lake issue between North Dakota and Manitoba. Well, that was when an issue when the United States side was going to pollute a body of water that was going to flow into Canada, and in this case is the shoes on the other foot. The United States was concerned that a body of water was going to be polluted to their detriment by their neighbor, and so that's against the 1909 Boundaries Waters Treaty, and the IJC, as it's known, is set up to sort of determine what outcomes or what course of action should be taken in the light of claims of contravention of that treaty. And they studied the matter for 3 years. A scientific panel of over 40 people issued a report in 1988 that very clearly said that if there was mining to go ahead in the Flathead, that it would be impact the water of the downstream neighbor of the United States. And so flash forward ahead to the middle of the 2000s, and Klein Mining shows up and starts trying to reopen those old coal mining trusts when the price of coal goes skyrocketing up and almost triples in a few years. And then they get pushed out of the original area that was proposed for coal mining by a coal staking reserve by the British Columbia government, which was put in place in 2005. And then they find another piece of coal in the Flathead that hadn't been previously proposed for a mine, but had been long known about and explored and whatnot. And they start trying to push that one forward as a mine. This is a company that at that time hadn't had any mining operations or hadn't done any mining of any kind. They're just an exploration company. And we again mount local protest and move the local MLA to stand up in the legislature in 2008 and say, I don't think the Flathead's a place that there should be mining, to his credit. He's a government MLA. And move folks on the United States side, and eventually find ourselves petitioning the United States World Heritage Committee to declare Waterton Glacier, which is the world's first international peace park and is a World Heritage Site, as a World Heritage Site in danger, which is a official designation under the UN, which puts a whole bunch of restrictions and special attention on a World Heritage Site. And we petitioned them. They heard our petition. They sent a scientific fact-finding mission right away, months after they heard our petition. They came in September 2009 and issued a report in January of 2010, right before the Olympics was going to start, and British Columbia was very concerned about an international incident that could potentially blacken their Olympic eye, and made an announcement with the Montana governor and the local forestry company and the First Nations. This is a Tanaha traditional territory. The Tanaha First Nation have long been in this area for thousands of years, of course. Long before there's any coal mining, and they all signed an agreement, a memorandum of understanding, that said there will be no coal mining in the Flathead Valley. And then finally, in November of 2011, the government actually passed legislation that created a permanent ban on all mining, oil and gas exploration and activity in the entire Flathead watershed.
So our great government was really drag kicking and screaming into banning it, but now they're faced with this $500 million suit. Have they settled with other companies in similar cases? What's their record on that?
Yeah, there's unfortunately a bit of sort of policy precedent on this. There's been settlements with companies who had. They were further down the road towards an actual mine. The most famous case is the Windy Craggy mine, and when the Tatshenshini Provincial Park was established way up in the northwest, where the company was compensated in the millions, and then not half a billion, but in the tens of millions, and then just most recently, Boss uranium mining company in the Okanagan was paid $30 million when the province decided that there would be no uranium mining in the entire province of British Columbia. So that's a bit of a bad precedent there, and they weren't all that far down the road, my understanding, of actually getting a mine going. So there is this really bad policy precedent, as well as this really outdated Mineral Tenure Act that sort of creates this environment where, you know, a mining company can bring forward such a outlandish claim for compensation.
And I understand there have even been some private conservation groups that have put in some money for compensation in such situations.
That's a new wrinkle, and that's sort of a special thing, a case with this Flathead deal, that part of the announcement in 2010 was that there would be compensation, but that it wouldn't cost the taxpayers of British Columbia any money. And so what ended up happening was Nature Conservancy Canada and The Nature Conservancy, which is their separate but similarly named organization on the U.S., side came up with almost $10 million in a fund to provide those funds necessary to compensate the companies, which is the estimate came from the provincial government. They said yes, it's going to in the negotiations with the various parties that were looking for this permanent prohibition. They said this is what we think it's going to cost, and you're going to have to find the money. We're not going to come up with that money. And the United States said, well, we're not going to come up with the money. And so then the private conservation funders stepped forward. And the truth be known, the Nature Conservancy Canada money came from, again, the taxpayers of Canada. The federal government, you may recall, donated, I don't want to get the number wrong, but I think it was in the area of $250 million to the Nature Conservancy of Canada in 2006 or 2007 as part of a private conservation fund for things like this. Also, some of that money was used for the Dark Woods purchased by Nature Conservancy Canada, which is in the West Kootenays, the largest private land conservation purchase in the history of Canada. So, you know, not the best use of those funds, if you ask me, but nevertheless, it provided an outcome that we were very, very keen to see.
Could you tell us what you would like to see happen?
Yeah, well, we'd like to see a change to the Mineral Tenure Act. That's the most important thing. We have an over 150-year-old act that was put together when this province was a very different place, and we were trying to entice people to get out on the land and give them all sorts of rights and entitlements in order to get them out there and settle this great province, you know, and get out there and explore and take risks. And we're not like that now. We've got, you know, we've got communities all over this province. We've got First Nations territories that are, you know, much more respected by the courts, have much more rights entitlements under court rulings. And we also have very much more awareness of the environmental sensitivities that are all over this province, from the valley bottoms up to the mountain peaks. And we need to change the Mineral Tenure Act. It's very outdated to reflect that 21st century understanding. And that would then prevent these ridiculous claims on compensation, because there wouldn't be this belief that there's a vested right just when you go online, pay $25 and start clicking a mouse in order to lay claim to various parts of the province, which is the situation that we have right now.
Well, thank you very much, Casey. It's been very clear and enlightening to hear your analysis. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Mordecai, for your time and interest.
I've been speaking with Casey Brennan. He's a program manager with WildSight, and you can learn more about this case at their website, wildsight.ca.